On April 19, 1692, a teenager named Abigail Hobbs was ordered to stand before Magistrate John Hawthorne and his assistant Jonathan Corwin. It's easy for us to imagine how terrified she must have been as she faced these two stern men of authority, anticipating their harsh questions about the worst crime imaginable. The witch hysteria had been going on for nearly 2 months by this point, and suddenly Abigail found herself in the crosshairs. Hawthorne's voice rang out, "Abigail Hobbs, you are brought before authority to answer to sundry acts of witchcraft committed by you against and upon the bodies of many. What say you? Are you guilty or not? Speak the truth." "I will speak the truth," Hobbs replied in what one might imagine to be a thin and trembling voice. "I've seen sights and been scared. I have been very wicked. I hope I shall be better and God will keep me." Her response surely must have sent a shiver down the spines of those who had gathered in the room for the examination, not counting the childish musings of 4-year-old Dorothy Good. The only other person to have confessed to any bad behavior up to this point had been Tituba at the very beginning of the crisis on March 1st. Now, weeks later, and after countless denials from numerous individuals, Abigail Hobbs had let it be known at the beginning of her questioning that she too had stories to tell. And a community that had been on the edge for weeks was surely sitting on the edge of its seat, waiting to hear what she was about to say. One relatively unique aspect about the Salem witch crisis is the extensive role that adolescent girls played in fanning the flames of fear and driving the hysteria forward. After all, the entire event was ignited by the claims of two preteen girls, Betty Paris and Abigail Williams, and Ann Putnam Jr., at just 12 years old, spent the entire crisis claiming to be afflicted, while prolifically accusing over 60 adults of witchcraft, including most of those who were convicted and executed. And several other girls and young women also claimed to be afflicted and made key accusations as well. It is perhaps because of the key role that these young girls played that many have dismissed the Salem witch hunt as the mere dramatics of teen and tween girls. But like most simple explanations of history, the answer isn't quite so black and white. Still, there's no denying how critical these young people were to the story. In fact, without their claims of affliction, accusations, and testimony against the accused, it's almost certain that the witch crisis in Salem would not have amounted to much at all. But like nearly every aspect of this story, there's something deeper driving the narrative, something that isn't so easy to explain. And as we peel away the layers, we uncover more intricate and complex detail. The story of the Hobbs family is one example of this complexity. William Hobbs, his wife Deliverance, and in particular their teenage daughter Abigail, each played an important part in the early months of the crisis. In 1692, they lived in Topsfield, a town located just northwest of Salem Village in what is known today as Middleton. Ultimately, all three Hobbs were accused of witchcraft, arrested, examined, and jailed over the course of the crisis. The Hobbs family, like several others who were involved in the Salem witch hysteria, had lived for a time on the Maine frontier. As we explored in our earlier episode, the unlikely role of New England's frontier in Salem, with historian Mary Beth Norton, the New England frontier seemed to play an important role in this story. and for the Hobbs family, it was a central part of their identity. According to Norton, the Hobbs family lived on Casco Bay near present-day Portland for about a decade, leading up to the witch crisis. They were likely driven away from the frontier, like many of their fellow European settlers, after an attack by the native Wabanaki who lived in the region in the early part of the 1690s. How a decade spent on the fierce and treacherous frontier might have shaped the role that the Hobbs family played in the witch crisis isn't exactly clear. But given the wild testimony that Abigail Hobbs would soon provide, it seems certain that her experiences in Maine, including what she might have been witness to there, as well as the fear that must have been cultivated within her while living under such precarious conditions, had to have made a serious impression on her life. In fact, during her examination, Abigail confessed to having seen a dog-like creature that she claimed was the devil 3 or 4 years earlier while living on the frontier. "What did he say to you?" Hawthorne asked her after she explained what she saw. "He said he would give me fine things if I did what he would have me," she replied. "And what would he have you do?" Hawthorne continued. "Why, he would have me be a witch," Abigail responded. Abigail then admitted to the magistrates that she had made a covenant with the devil, but that she had hoped that God would forgive her for doing so. She admitted to putting her hand on the devil's book multiple times and agreeing to do his bidding for a set period of time in exchange for such nice things. Abigail had further claimed that the devil had asked her to harm Ann Putnam Jr. and Mercy Lewis, two of the girls who had made accusations against her. "What did you do to them when you hurt them?" Hawthorne asked her. "I pinched them," Abigail replied. "How did you pinch them? Do you go on your own person to them?" Hawthorne questioned further. "No." "Doth the devil go for you?" Hawthorne asked. "Yes," Abigail replied. Mercy Lewis, who lived with Ann Putnam as the family's maidservant, had also lived in Casco Bay at the same time as the Hobbs family. It seems certain that they would have known each other there before they both eventually ended up in Salem right before the beginning of the witch crisis. Let's paint the picture of what is happening. It's not difficult to imagine a teenager eagerly sharing vivid and embellished stories about their wild adventures in a rugged and dark place that they know those who they are talking to greatly fear and will likely never see. For European Americans, Maine was America's first frontier, and for the average Puritan living in and around the relative calm of Salem, that rugged and untamed region was extraordinarily dangerous, particularly because it was rife with what they considered to be heathen Native Americans. Most Puritans believed that the native peoples who were living among and around them were in league with the devil, and it's easy to imagine the vivid and frightening stories that the Hobbs family, Mercy Lewis, or other Europeans who had lived on the frontier might eagerly share with their naive brethren in Salem. The dangers, both real and embellished, that they might pass on to those who will never see the frontier for themselves. Human nature often drives us to accentuate or exaggerate the danger that we experience. Of course Abigail Hobbs would meet the devil in the wilds of Maine, and nobody in Salem would bat an eye at such a revelation. And given how skittish the people of Salem must have been after weeks of witch-related hysteria, stories about the frontier from their neighbors who had lived there must have hit particularly hard. As she was examined further, Abigail Hobbs claimed that she was aware that Sarah Good, one of the first women to be accused weeks earlier, was a witch. Eventually, she claimed to have suddenly become deaf, and her examination that day was brought to a close. Meanwhile, the afflicted girls who were witnessing Abigail's examination claimed to see both Sarah Good as well as another previously accused witch, Sarah Osborne, putting their fingers into Abigail's ears. It seemed that a vast conspiracy of evil was being revealed by the teenagers on both sides. Although in an interesting twist, the accused girls, Ann Putnam Jr., Mercy Lewis, and Abigail Williams, each expressed their compassion for their peer, Abigail Hobbs. The next day, at another examination, Abigail seemed to double down on her claims of being a witch. She told her examiners now that she had conspired with Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and another so-called witch from Boston named Judah White, who had also once lived on the Maine frontier, to harm Ann Putnam, Mercy Lewis, and Abigail Williams. She also admitted that they gathered in a pasture adjacent to the parsonage where Reverend Samuel Parris himself lived, to celebrate the devil by engaging in the twisted sacraments of eating red bread and drinking red wine. Abigail also accused the former reverend of Salem Village Church, George Burroughs, a man who had spent time on the Maine frontier as well, of witchcraft. In fact, while being interviewed in jail that May, Abigail Hobbs seemed to have no qualms whatsoever about admitting to her misdeeds. She claimed to have afflicted numerous people during her time on the frontier, including conspiring with Burroughs to kill a woman named Mary Lawrence by sticking a thorn into a poppet. Back in April, a few days after Abigail Hobbs was originally examined, her stepmother, Deliverance, was questioned before the magistrates as well. And now the gloves were off. The 50-year-old woman who is William's second wife had previously claimed to be attacked by Sarah Wilds, another accused woman. But given what her stepdaughter had just admitted to, the magistrates had set their sights on Deliverance as well. There was no doubt in their minds that Abigail's stepmother was also a witch. Deliverance's early denials of wrongdoing quickly dissolved under the merciless pressure of the magistrate's questioning, and she soon confessed to having signed the devil's book. It was a classic example of the kind of coercive questioning that can lead to a false confession. From this point forward, Deliverance began to freely acknowledge herself as a witch and made accusations against a host of other people. She had become putty in the authorities' hands, telling them whatever she thought they wanted to hear. Why Abigail's stepmother chose to give in and falsely confess is not known. Perhaps her stepdaughter's vivid and damning testimony had weakened her ability to resist. This fact, coupled with the unrelenting pressure from the magistrates, made any denials futile, and Deliverance might have simply decided that her best course of action was to throw herself at the mercy of justice, hoping that her accusations against others might be enough to save her life. Whatever the case, Deliverance's husband, William Hobbs, took the entirely opposite approach. While being questioned by the magistrates the same day as his wife, he firmly and coolly denied everything. "I am as clear as a newborn babe," he is recorded as responding to the claims from the so-called afflicted girls. When the girls then proceeded to engage in fits and cries of pain upon hearing his testimony, a regular occurrence now over the course of the crisis, William remained completely unmoved. In response to the magistrate's queries about how he could be so certain of his innocence in the face of the commotion being made by the accusers, William waved it off. "You may judge your pleasure. My soul is clear," he said. "I can deny it to my dying day." Still, the magistrates certainly must have thought that they had struck gold with the Hobbs family, and they were not about to give up so easily on William. They relentlessly pursued him, perhaps assuming he was the ringleader of it all. But William was up to the task. When asked why he left the room whenever scripture was read, he denied doing so, when asked why he had not attended church for some time, William claimed that he had not been well. When asked who he worshipped, William answered that he hoped it was God only. And when told by the magistrates that God requires outward worship, Hobbes coolly replied to them that he worships God in his heart. William Hobbes was not going to cower before the authorities or beg for his life, and he was not going to be bullied into saying things that weren't true. Yet William's denials did no more to save him than his wife and daughter's confessions. Like the other members of the Hobbes family, William was arrested and held in the Salem jail for months. Although Abigail was eventually sentenced to be executed by the Court of Oyer and Terminer in September, fortunately she and the rest of her family escaped the hangman when the court was disbanded later that fall. In many ways, the Hobbes family represents the full spectrum of the Salem witch crisis. Abigail decided to admit guilt fully. Deliverance first denied and then admitted guilt, while William firmly denied any wrongdoing at all. But why exactly Abigail and her stepmother Deliverance confessed to such actions remains an enduring mystery. Whatever the reason, Abigail in particular seemed to take pleasure in shocking people with her behavior. Historian Marilyn Roach has suggested that Abigail had told acquaintances, perhaps in jest, that she had sold her soul to the devil, and that he had protected her from Indian attacks while she was on the frontier. Abigail had also been known to regularly make crude and unkind comments about her stepmother, as well as mock various religious rituals. Perhaps Abigail was merely playing a role as a jokester. Perhaps when the witch hysteria struck, she saw it as an opportunity to step into the spotlight. Perhaps she was playing a role right from the start, mocking the entire process with her overt lies. Or perhaps she really believed the things that she was saying. Or perhaps she was the victim of trauma from her years living on the frontier. Whatever the case, the story of Abigail Hobbes represents a particularly jarring enigma in this complex and tangled story. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.